To see examples of what we talked about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction.
Al's just kind of sitting there reading. He's like, yeah, go ahead, start it.
Oh, yeah, I'm ready.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Two Dimension Comics, the podcast with no direction. This is episode number 153. I'm your host, Dallas, and with me today we have...
Don.
And Al.
Yeah, right. It's the Dream Team again, minus Rook, who will hopefully be here next time.
Yeah.
What's up, guys?
Not
too much. How are you, man?
I'm doing pretty good. Al's got his nose in a book. He's reading some Frank Frazetta stuff, right?
Well, yeah, it's this book that I just got called The Adventures of the Snowman.
You mean you got it a week ago?
Yeah. Well, I just got it, yeah, a week ago, yeah. Man, this book is from 1944. It was the
what?
This is one of the first comic books that he ever did. He was a kid. He was like 15 years old when he did this. This is very cool. This is like opening up, like, you know, the Frank Frazetta, you know, that you
archives
that you never saw before. It's very crude, but man, this guy got good in a hurry.
Well, you know, when you say crude, I'm looking at it thinking, I wish I could draw like that.
Right? That's way better than me. Jeez.
Yeah, it's he had skills. And it reminds me, some of the figures reminds me of Milton Caniff. Not the snowman itself, but it doesn't look like the Frazetta that was doing comics, you know, years later.
It looks like animation, you know, like a Popeye cartoon or something.
I'm like half up on the table, leaning over, trying to see it.
I'm trying to see it too. It's the first time.
This is a strange book, because I pointed out to Al, because anything Frazetta related, Al jumps on. And I thought that was strange, because it's a short book and long, like, you know, a comic strip size. Kind of like those Garfield books they printed in the 80s.
Yep.
Or the Daily Strip.
I used to get those. I got every book.
Yeah, well, a lot of people did. But it's a little bigger than that, but it's a hardback. But it just said across the top, Frank Frazetta, and underneath, Snowman. And you look above it, it says, The Adventures of the Snowman. And I never heard of it. And the cover drawing's not really too much. And I looked at the back panel, and I thought, well, I guess it is Frank Frazetta. But it was shrink wrap, so you couldn't look at the insides. And I showed it to Al, and Al immediately said that was his first work. And he was a young man when he got it, and Al bought the book. I have to admit, after he tore it open and we looked at it, I'm a lot more impressed. It looks like it was colored in colored pencil.
He actually copyrighted it. It's got the copyright of 1942. So he was, I think he was even younger than that.
So Frazetta copy wrote it?
Yeah, look at it.
Did he write it?
Yeah, there's
yeah,
an
he
official.
Wrote it.
That's like a copy of the copyright transcript.
He did it when he was a kid, and then he just copyrighted it, yeah.
Good for him.
Well, you know, I was just thinking, if everybody was as smart as Frank Frazetta, maybe comics wouldn't be in
the situation
they're
in.
It's kind of an anti-war thing, because he's fighting the Japanese or whatever, but it's a very...
Well, it's the time.
It's
yeah,
kind of like, it's good to see the very, very earliest things of these great artists, because it kind of like, you know, you can see where everything came from, and you can see how quickly they got so much better, you know, after this. I can't really talk much about it, because I've read through the book, but I want to research it a little more, but it's like you said, we were at the store, and I kept looking and looking and looking, and then you're the one who goes, hey, there's a Frazetta book down there, and I went, oh, yeah? And I went, oh, okay. All right, I don't have this one. I'm going to get it. And I did.
Well, it's a knight of Dark Horse. It's from Dark Horse.
Yeah,
from Dark
Horse,
yeah.
What's interesting when you look at it is, from what I saw, every page is one panel.
Yeah, I think it was a flip book.
Oh, really?
I think.
Yeah, it's one long
white panel.
I'm
flipping it really fast, but he's not moving.
Yeah.
Ba-dum-ba-dum.
It was given to his son. So his son decided, instead of, you know, keeping it, let me just... you know, put it for everybody to have or whatever. It's a nice little memento.
Was it... it was never printed?
No.
Oh,
There's only like a couple of panels. I have seen a couple of panels in fanzines in the 70s, but this was never printed before. This was the father gave it to the son and said, hey, you know, I want you to have this from my collection. No, this was never printed.
He just did that for himself.
Yeah, he just did it for himself, yeah.
Looks like you're right, Don, about it being in colored and colored pencils.
Yeah, that's what. Yeah. But it's nice. Yeah, he's got all the shading and graduations and stuff, modeling. He's he had the skill set, and I mean, a young man, I'd be happy in my 50s if I could draw something like that.
I think he later on went and did a book called Snowman with John Gunta, but this was before that. I'm pretty sure this was some done on his own when he was a young boy. So it's pretty amazing. Yeah, that's exactly why I bought it. That's never been printed before.
Yeah, and it's nice.
It's a facet of that I never had.
Kind of incredible.
Yeah, I have to say it's the cover was misleading to me. When you look at the insides, it's actually a lot of fun. And the cover's not much. The snowman character himself, I don't think, is really that great of a character, even though he's in it most of the time. But when you see all the other stuff going on, it's neat. And it's just a fun, and it's also a youthful enthusiasm going through, which is, you can see.
I mean, it does have stereotypical Japanese, evil Japanese, because it was World War II, but...
Yeah. They've got the same look that you saw from when comic artists were drawing the Japanese.
Yeah, in the 40s, yeah, because it was propaganda.
Well, even the movies. Yes. Anytime you saw any Asian person in the movies in that time, and yes. When I was in college, they talked to us in American history class about there was never a time you didn't see any Asian person that wasn't sinister and evil. And Studs Terkel did a book called The Good War. It was an oral history of World War II. And there was a woman talking about, in the United States, I think she was in California, and she was so embarrassed because some of the kids her kids were friends with were, from Japanese families. And they were over there watching TV, and I don't know, it was a cartoon or something came on that showed the Japanese and how they were portrayed. And she was so horrified and embarrassed, and these kids were just kind of staggered, And she goes, well, how can you explain to them? Because they're Americans, too. It was their country. And so some of the kids were in tears when they saw it. It was hurtful. Yeah. Well, I'm sorry. The woman was just carrying on about how bad. I'm thinking, well, it was a war. You got to understand the time, and it wasn't right, but that's how it was. And those kids are Americans, and this is everybody was portrayed like they're evil. That's just what they do, and go on from there. But yeah, the Popeye cartoons I love dearly. The Fleischer Popeyes. When I was a little kid in the 60s, I remember sometimes on TV they'd show those where it was Popeye fighting the Japanese Navy. And they'd have a Japanese sailor come out with a round glasses and a buck teeth. He'd go, so sorry, so sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And it always bothered me. I said, God, I don't like that guy. Why don't I like that guy? I didn't equate him with a Japanese person. But it would irritate me. Well, it was propaganda. It was war propaganda, and everybody's putting it out because the whole world was fighting, and they were one of the enemies. So,
It's just the way it was back then. And, the Warner Brothers cartoons did the same thing. Like they would, Bugs Bunny would fight. Hey Moto, stuff like that.
Yes,
that was just the way it was. It's historical, and it should be seen.
It shouldn't be hid away or anything like that.
It wasn't just obviously the Japanese. It was racial caricatures everywhere. I mean, remember in The Spirit, Ebony, and a lot of African Americans at the time of the 40s and the 50s were shown in a very certain way, exaggerated poses.
Yeah, it's just historical.
But, even though
you have to look at it as a sign of the times, as opposed to and realize that we've gone further than.
But Ebony, we've talked about it before. Even though Ebony was not a racial stereotype you want, I always loved Ebony. He was a good character.
He was a good character, yeah.
And, they always talk about they don't know what to do with him. Well, Darma Cook kind of updated him quite well in his Spirit work, but Ebony was a character I really liked and loved. And I guess you could just look at it as a little homely character. They could have done that with any type. I don't think it was a hate character.
No, it was just, like I said, it was just his... What was happening? Amos and Andy, stuff like that.
Blackface, yeah.
Yeah, that kind
of
stuff.
Amos and Andy was a little different. It was a radio show. Now, I was too young. I remember, I guess they had a series of movies or TV shows. And one time I was with my aunt in Texas. This was like 74. And my aunt it was late night TV and we were talking, and all of a sudden the TV had Amos and Andy. He goes, that's Amos and Andy. And it's from the 50s. He goes, look, I haven't seen them since I was little. And later there's another guy came in, it was Kingfish. You know, and he goes, oh, that's Kingfish. I didn't know who these guys were. But when I was in college in American history, the professor was talking about, you know, the history of radio and stuff like that. And he started talking about Amos and Andy. And he was explaining about how popular the show was. He says movie theaters were having trouble on the nights that they played Amos and Andy on the radio. So what they had to do was the radio, you know, theater, I mean TV theaters were advertising on the radio that in the middle of the movie, when Amos and Andy comes on, they'd stop the movie, play Amos and Andy over the theater's, you know, sound system, and then resume the movie when the show was over.
My God, it was that popular.
It was that popular. And he said, a lot of people now, this is in 1981 when he was teaching, but he said, a lot of people talk about now Amos and Andy was racist, you know, prejudice. This is, that was nonsense. This is, everybody loved Amos and Andy. Well, come to find out, on the radio, Amos and Andy was two white guys. All the actors in the show were white guys acting like they were black. But when they, you know, television came out and they started, whatever those shows, or they were movies or they were television shows, they hired black actors to play those characters that white people were doing. And I mean, I imagine that, I don't know, maybe it would be considered derogatory, but the people loved the show. It was a popular show. Mm-hmm. And I've never heard it, but it was extremely popular and everybody liked it.
Nice. Overall, though, that getting back to Frazetta, that book is cool because, I mean, obviously it's early work. He was very young. The art is still better than what I can do, but it's relatively simple compared to Frazetta's professional work, really. But he still has some. Almost every shot is dynamic.
Oh yeah,
it's from a really interesting perspective. So
easy to follow too.
Yes.
Easy to follow.
So that's cool. That's a good find, Al.
Yeah, I'm reading through it, and I'm not sure if he did this, because it's confusing in the way he wrote it, even though maybe I'm just not reading it well. I'm not sure if he did it when he was 12 and a half or 15, because it says here, shockingly, my father's comic characters were created 9 years prior to the Frosty the Snowman, as we're all familiar with. Frosty started as a hit Christmas song in the winter of 1950, and with its popularity, the cute Christmas tale soon followed. One may wonder why nothing ever came of the Snowman comic, especially since he went through the trouble to file for the copyright. But knowing my father the way I did, I'm aware he felt the aggravation, money, and time involved to protect his copyright was rarely worth the hassle at any time in his career. Living to the fullest each day was at the forefront, and money worries and stress had no place in his life. But then it says, when I look closely at the Snowman work, I'm astonished that a 15-year-old boy created it over 70 years ago.
15-year-old boy.
So I'm not sure if he was 12 and a half. It says that he went and wrote it at 12 and a half, but it was a 15-year-old boy. So I'm imagining it's a 15-year-old did it. And it's right before the Snowman comic book with John Gunta. So it's pretty amazing. This guy was painting. Frazetta was painting doing paintings when he was 8 years old. He got accepted into an art class. So he was pretty wild. He was a pretty amazing dude.
He just kept improving until he turned into that god that we all saw in the 70s.
He's one of those people that their reputation precedes itself.
But you know,
like, people know who Frazetta is, even
because
if you're
of the
not
album
a big person
covers
in the art world
and all that stuff.
Right, because album covers and
But you know, when he started doing when in the 50s, when he started doing Little Abner, he was getting good money, but he ended up having a fallout with Al Capp, as mostly everybody did. And he was trying to get back in the comic industry, and he actually, in the late 50s, went to DC and places, and they were turning him down because they said that, oh, no, your art style is outdated now. We got a different style now. So it was because of, like, other artists that got him work, and then what happened was you know, ding, ding, Creepy magazine put him on the cover, and then he started doing paperbacks for the Edgar Rice Burroughs books, and then he became like a big hotshot with Conan.
That's right. No, that's exactly right.
So, you know,
because
even a guy
the
that
mainstream.
Great was actually, you know, going through a hard time because, you know,
and he couldn't get work in comics, which is hilarious, which is ironic.
So he would do other things too. He couldn't get work in comics. Incredible. So,
which is funny though, because to his thankfully, he couldn't get work in comics at the time, and he had to go and do other things, because thanks to the Edgar Rice Burroughs books like that in other medium, he became popular, made him what he is. Yeah, if he had stuck to strictly comics, I doubt he'd be nearly as big as he is.
Well, I do agree with it. And one thing I've always said, and I mean, you can agree or disagree on it, I love Frank Frazetta. And whenever you read about him and they talk about his comics work, they always show a couple of panels. It's rare they ever show a whole page, you know. It's just certain panels, and you're thinking, my, that's incredible, you know. But I would buy reprints of, like, The Black Knight.
The
Shiny Knight, I think, for DC.
Yeah.
I'd buy some of those reprints, and the covers would always catch me. But then I'd read the interiors. I have to admit, I just didn't really enjoy them. I found them too much. His comics pages... It just seemed like if you cut them panel to panel, looked at them, they were staggering. Now, I think it was the romance books he did for Standard Comics. You have some of those?
Mm.
That's a bit different. Those I did enjoy. And there was another story. He had another book called Thunder.
Thunder, yeah.
And that one's a bit different.
The Tarzan-ish guy.
Yeah. The Jungle Guy.
The Jungle Guy.
Some artists, especially fine artists, would be better accustomed to just doing covers, though. It would be hard for them to...
Yeah, his pages...
It is different. Mm-hmm. It is a different...
I don't really enjoy his comic pages too much. I want to say that the panels themselves are staggering, but the pages don't flow to me and they don't interest me. Now, he did Little Abner for a long time, and those are incredible. Those are strong. But to me, his paintings, just one painting tells the whole story. I mean, you can get yourself immersed in it. Every time I bought those Edgar Rice Burroughs books and other science fiction books like that, those pocket paperbacks, you just sit there and stare at the cover. You leave it on a table or a bookshelf or something just so you could see it, and they would just suck you in.
And that's the strength of an artist that does just covers. You know what I mean? Like, he's got that moxie, those images that just draw you in and pull you in, and you want to sit there and stare at it and figure out the story behind it, you know?
See
that in, I remember... the old Preacher comic from the late 90s, the cover artist, his name was Glenn Fabry, and it was all painted, hyper-realistic, detailed covers. And each of those covers was fantastic, and it had a little story in and of itself. It wasn't always as encompassing or as detailed as a Frazetta. Hmm. Sometimes it was just a close-up of a character shot, but they all looked so intriguing and sucked you in.
Well, the thing about Frazetta's work, too, is that the cover work, the painted work, was if you really look at it, it's really simple. It's like simple... compositions, sometimes really simple, like color scheme. But what he did within those, the simplicity of it was make it like more, you know. I mean, he used a simple template to make something that was really visceral. And, you know, when you look at somebody like Jack Kirby, who's another one of the guys that I consider just like Frazetta or whatever, you know. There's a simplicity there, but there's a Kirby's a lot more complicated.
Well, the devil's in the details. I mean, especially for Frazetta, like you were saying, it might be a simple composition, but man, the length he goes to make it look so realistic or intriguing and just fantastical sometimes, because a lot of it was Tarzan and stuff like that, you know, or like sword and sorcery stuff.
But both Kirby and Frazetta had a power to their work, which is what draws your attention to them. They jumped at you, you know, and then when they catch your attention, then you start really looking at them and go, why am I liking this so much? Is it because this woman's really hot and she looks great? Is it because this guy isn't this monster that this, you know, this horrible, evil looking monster is coming out? He basically, you know, those two had something in their, you know, genetic disposition that made their work more powerful. Other artists had different talents that draws you to them, like Wally Wood had his, you know, inking style or lighting style or whatever, and then you had, you know, everybody.
Toth also, that inking
Toth had the ultimate great designer that could make any, invented his own language for drawing. Yeah, all these guys, but these guys were the most powerful ones in a lot of ways.
I mean, Kirby was literally busting out of the page. Like, you couldn't contain his art in a panel. You know, it was coming out of the panels. It was breaking through.
Because
it was so dynamic.
Yeah. And it was unrestrained imagination with Jack Kirby.
Whereas somebody like Mobius, there's a power to it, but it seems like there's a lot of intellect in his art.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. It's more subtle in some ways.
There's a lot of power there. Yeah. No doubt about it. But a lot of intellect and a lot of, like, brains going on, as opposed to just visceral
And Mobius's style, and I don't say this derogatively, but it's the simplicity in it. Yeah. What I mean is the clean lines, the less is more kind of a style of thinking of what he does. Well, at least on his later Mobius.
Yeah, his
stuff.
Early work was a lot of detail, which again, a lot of people get upset about that, but some artists start out drawing a lot of detail. Jaime Hernandez is another one. He used to do a lot of rendering.
He simplified his style, like Wally Wood did and everybody else.
And if people would get upset about that they like, some people love a lot of detail. That artist, William Stout, he's continued to work a lot of detail. In some ways, though, William Stout has a simplicity to some of his work, even though he uses a lot of detail. But some of these, again, Mobius and Jaime Hernandez are the two biggest culprits, I think, that people get upset that they start working with a simple one line weight. And they keep it simple, but they also explain that it's harder to draw simply than it is to add a lot of detail.
Well, you know what it is, too? It's like sometimes when you start out, you put a lot of details, but when you see the artist simplifying, it means they figured it out.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right there. And, I mean, yeah, look at Jaime Hernandez and Mobius. Their styles are so unique. Right when you see a piece of art drawn by them, you know it's them. Because they found their voice. They've created their own style. It's them. They're not emulating anyone else. No one can emulate them. That's right then
all
and
the
there. That's their distinct.
Have been absorbed.
That's
They've been intellectualized. And
like you've got it, man.
Out.
You did it.
You
like
know,
that's,
yeah, exactly.
That's
just,
your
I used
peak.
To draw like Archie. Now it's all synthesized, and this is different. It might look like it to you, but it's not. This is what everything. And now I've taken it to the level where I don't need all these details. This is what I'm going to give you. This is the bare. Not the bare minimum, but this is the essence of what, you know, Kirby did it.
I was,
all refined
you're
his
right.
artwork.
Kirby is so refined and stylized in that respect too. Maybe he might be a little more detailed in ways, but that doesn't matter. He's got such a distinct voice, just like Mobius, just like Hernandez. Mm-hmm. You look at his art and you know, oh, that's a Kirby. Like you can't mistake that for someone else's art, for someone else's style.
You know, one thing we talk a lot about. Jack Kirby's Marvel work, you know, all the superhero work and stuff.
At least every episode.
Well, yeah. But
yeah, well, yeah.
I just read something somebody was posting about his Fourth World stuff when he went to D.C. You know, Carmen Infantino, from what I understand, he was the one that brought him into D.C. And I guess he was also the one that kind of gave him the boot. Carmen Infantino, I was surprised, never liked Jack Kirby, even though he was the one that brought him in. And I never quite understood. And somebody, I think it was on a Facebook group, was talking about it. And they said that, if you think about it, when Jack Kirby came to DC, DC brought him in to do more comic book superheroes like he did at Marvel. But he said when he actually went to DC, he didn't really do any superheroes. He created gods, he created monsters, he
sci-fi.
Created demons. Well,
yeah
it was.
But, sci-fi,
I mean, you know, the Fourth World stuff, you know, it was the new gods. You know, the new gods, Darkseid, you know, he had... all that stuff, which was kind of odd and creepy. I mean, I liked it, but, you know, then he did the demon, you know, it was demon-type stuff, a lot of mutants, a lot of things like that in it. And when he did, I guess you call them superheroes, but when he did Omak, which is one of my favorites, he was kind of he was a superhero, but he wasn't really Captain America-type superhero. It was kind of like Blade Runner, you know. In likes, I never thought of it that way. Everything was kind of no hope, you know, Commandy.
Yeah.
Everything was kind of.
Well, it was the '70s.
Yeah, well, I say that I liked them. A lot of my cousins had random issues of Demon and some of this other stuff, but I thought, yeah, it is true. It was, and you know, looking back at the Fourth World, when I was a kid, I picked these up because. You had hippies walking around everywhere, you know, young people with long hair, beards, you know, bright clothing. You know, you see Jimi Hendrix albums everywhere and all the psychedelic stuff, Peter Max posters. There was, in school, they had Peter Max no smoking posters everywhere, cafeteria and the gymnasium.
Who's Peter Max? Don't give me that look.
He's going to give you the look, yeah.
Okay, Peter.
I didn't exist in the 70s.
Okay.
Or in the 60s.
Yeah, see, Peter Max, he was I guess you call him a psychedelic artist.
He was the prototypical, like, pop art. Not pop art, psychedelic artist.
Well, right? He's kind of pop art.
Kind of pop
he,
art.
What I always noticed about Peter Max was his colors. Now, I guess they were kind of surreal. They were line drawings, But he had these bright magentas and cyans and, you know, violets and stuff, yellows. But and blends, which is something you see a whole lot.
Was it like the look of the decade or the look of the 60s?
Kind of.
Yeah, yeah. I started noticing late 60s. Yeah, I started noticing in the early 70s. But there was a series of no smoking posters he did for schools. And he always had his name at the bottom, Peter Max. Kind of like how Barry Smith always had that big logo.
The square and the B.
Yeah. But Peter Max, his color was really something. And, I mean, they were of the time. I remember he had a Pepsi advertisement. A lot of it was, you know, he was an advertising artist. But he always had his name on it. And it was always for youthful products.
Yeah, look him up.
And then after that, he kind of vanished to me. And then I was in San Francisco in 1983, and I was hitting all the art galleries. And I saw four of his prints. But they weren't the line surrealistic line drawings I always saw. One was like a still life. It was almost like done in pencil, but it was like, you know, stuff on a table, some bowls, some fruit and stuff like that.
Didn't look anything like the 60s war.
Except that he had those bright neon colors.
Oh, okay.
But it was, I thought, staggering at the time. You got me, I was fresh out of college. I went to the Navy. I was still into all that. And, you know, at the gallery on his section, you know, I said, I remember him. And he was talking about he was always known for his color. And so he's always had the vibrancy and stuff. And he did understand color. And I found out when Miami was doing the South Beach, you know, that whole development, they brought him in. He was one of the planners for the color.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't either. All the condos and the hotels and all this stuff, he was the one they brought in. And he decided all those Miami Vice colors that they started using in the TV show, which made sense.
He's responsible for that.
Well, it had a kind of a neon subtlety.
Yeah,
I remember
I loved it.
The Miami Vice TV show, I was reading about that in Time Magazine back in 1984 or 85. And they were explaining about how they filmed it, and they had to film something outside a building in a parking lot. You know, parking lot was black asphalt with white parking lines. And they said they didn't really quite go to it, so the film crew repainted all the white lines peach. Which, again, when you watch it on a show, it's still white lines, but it has that peach tint to it. That's the kind of extent, but that was a Peter Max influence. When Holly's little, Target had a series of party bags, and you know, sometimes a friend of hers would come to one of her birthdays and she'd have these Peter Max party bags. That's Peter Max.
That's interesting.
But it was more of an updated than his 70s work. But
you know, speaking of Miami Vice, my friend told me this. I can't prove this, but he told me that. I go, you may be right. I'm not really the... We were talking about rights, music rights on shows. He says that Miami Vice isn't available on DVD or anything like that because of music rights.
Well, the same
because of all the songs that are
of all
there.
And that the same thing happened to Northern Exposure, that TV show.
Really?
No, they did put them out on DVD, and I've got some of them. But people were complaining because they would play music over the show. I mean, all kinds of music.
They
play opera. They play folk songs. They play country songs, Cajun stuff. You name it, and rock stuff. But what happened was, is a lot of these shows they didn't, you know, foresee a different format. Wonder Years is another one.
Yeah.
And
they
could.
There's a version where they had a cover of it, but it wasn't by Joe Cocker. They got some guy imitating Joe Cocker.
Well, because what happened was when they started using rock songs in advertising instead of using jingles, all of a sudden the prices for those songs went through the roof, and those shows couldn't afford it.
Yep.
Now, Northern Exposure, they did put them out on DVD, and to me they were fine, but people complained that some of the songs are different than what they originally had, and it says it changes the tone of the show. Well, it's still, to me, the same show, but some of those songs, they were done for that show, you know, put in the show, they were written for that. And, there's a lot of that. It's just stuff that you didn't quite foresee, and all of a sudden you can't afford it, you know. So,
Being the podcast with no direction.
Yeah, that was great. We got on a Northern Exposure.
And Miami Vice.
Let's take a music break, guys. We'll be right back.
You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you would like to hear our older episodes, you can find them on our blog. Just go to bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
Oh, hello everyone, we're all, and welcome back. I almost did the intro to the episode. That was the Jezebels. I've played them at least once before, they're an Australian band, I think.
They're a good band as well.
Yeah, they're pretty great. So that's one of their older songs, which flipping love. What are we talking about now?
Well, that book you
Yeah, exactly. I want to talk about this.
Yes, I've been waiting for this.
Now, we've mentioned this, and as a matter of fact, in every episode, we also say that, you know, on the sidebar, you can find Dallas's comic book, The Mighty Blue.
Yeah, I have a webcomic, mightybluecomic.blogspot.com.
Now, let me forward this. Dallas and I are friends. If you listen to the show, you absolutely know it.
Liar.
But whenever we talk about The Mighty Blue, I am actually very unforgiving to this guy. He put this out every week for a long time.
Is it done, by the way?
It's not done, and because of the fact that I'm having a baby and I've just been so busy lately, I haven't done any new pages in quite a while. So I think I have 113 parts out so far, or 112.
Your novel, right?
It's a sequel, basically, to my novel. Sequel. But I release them one-page increments, like a one-page webcomic, and then I used to do it every week, but it's gone long by the wayside since. You were saying, Donnie?
Well, Donnie.
Donnie, baby.
Now, I wrote Dallas's case on this, because one thing I don't mind sometimes, but it seemed like every cartoon, every show, ever since my daughter was born, the woman is smart and the man's a blithering idiot. Now, at the same time, it used to be you never saw that. So when I first started seeing it, it's kind of funny, and everybody should have equal opportunity. But it swings from one side all the way over. Okay, finally, it's just all the time. So you can imagine my shock and my disdain when my buddy does a comic book where the woman is smart and the guy is a blithering idiot. I mean, really, you're going to add the fuel to the fire. Same time in the comic strip, I love Valerian, the same thing. Right? The guy's not a blithering idiot, but basically a lot of times he's kind of forlorn, and he gets kind of caught up in something, you know, not paying attention, and Loreline has to pull him out of it, which was kind of neat, and, you know, it's not quite as cartoony. Anyway, I've ridden Dallas, and he's taking it. Well, when I got an iPad, Dallas gave me all the PDFs to the comic strip. I have to say, reading it week by week, page by page on the internet, it's a different experience than actually reading it, you know, all together in one volume.
As
in your
one
hand.
Story. Yeah.
And it reads quite well. One thing that staggers me, how many pages is this?
113?
Okay, so, well, first off, let me say, the PDF version that I gave you, I'm working on a printed version that's going to be a collected edition. I've got a ton of bonus material and additional material that goes with this collected edition, including a map. I've got a brief history of the world the characters live in, pages and pages of that. I have chapter breaks, a bunch of stuff. So the PDF itself probably clocks in at about 147 pages.
Oh,
only 112 pages of that is the book, is the comic itself, and the rest is just ancillary material, right? So yeah, it's about almost 150 pages, and I recently had one copy printed up by a print-on-demand company just to see what it's going to look like. And so I have the physical version right here in my hand.
Which is outstanding.
The only one in the world. And I just want to say that we were talking about, before the music break, Kirby, Frazetta, artists that have their own voice and they're various, but I'm very generic in my art, so you couldn't tell my art from the next schmo. But it works with the story. I think, hopefully, my strength would be in the storytelling, dialogue.
It reads quite well. There's a few things that always catches me on this. When I read the whole thing, the guy doesn't turn out to be as stupid as I was thinking when I read it weekly.
Damn straight.
And Dallas always said he gets better. I think he's not getting better enough. Well, when you read the whole thing in context, even though he does kind of come across as, you know, a bit of an idiot, he's not. And even though the woman comes across as thinking she knows everything and actually pulling things off, well, she's not really all that smart either. Part of it, he's shown, is a miscommunication between people, which is something that happens in everyday life and something I like. I never got lost reading, and that's saying something, because I've tried to do comics, and I've shown to people, and they're like, oh, I like the drawings, but what's going on here? You know, I mean, it happens. I've even read professional comics, not so much anymore, but especially in the 80s, early 80s, and late 70s, I'd read sometimes comics that made absolutely no sense. The storytelling was just horrifying, even though the drawings were good. Another thing that surprises me is you got a lot of different characters. You're following two characters, but there's other characters that show up right and left, which makes for a really rich world, and it's something I appreciate.
Thank you.
And I never get confused or lost when I'm following that. Every time a character shows up, I'm like, oh, okay, that's that character. I got it. You got the Abominable Snowman, which I did read weekly, but I found it read a lot different reading it all together. There are two parts that, and you and I have talked about this before. There's one panel where there's an old man explaining the history. And it's basically several panels of this guy, you know, following him with nothing else. What I would have liked is if he would have had in the background, whenever he's talking, just a vague type of tribal-looking, you know, rendering or something of what he was talking about. Because I did stop when I was reading that book. I said, oh, I tried to read the first panel, and then I put it down. And later I picked it up and tried to read it again. That stopped, to me, stopped the flow of the story. And when I told you that, you said, well, that's what I wanted. Okay.
Well, let me ask you a question, more technical drawing-wise. Are you drawing that with a mouse pad or something?
No, I'm doing the most basic thing in the world. So I start everything off in pencil on physical paper. Right. I don't actually do the art.
You
I don't
scan
draw
it.
Anything. Yeah, what I do... I do the breakdowns, you know, as usual artists would do. I sketch the breakdowns of the art.
Uh-huh.
What's that?
It's your drawing table.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
I sketch the breakdowns of the art, and then I'll get, you know, paper. I usually don't use... My weakness is I don't use oversized paper.
Mm.
I use a standard size 8.5 by 11 sheet for the most part, right? I draw everything up. I use rulers to set up the panel borders and what have you for the most part. Draw in pencil. I use a fine tip ink pen to do all the details, and then a kind of a fatter ink. I don't remember the brand I use. I'll have to look it up. Sorry, I'm not a professional artist. Anyway, so I ink everything in. I draw it and ink it. Then I scan everything into Photoshop, where I do all the color separations and the tones and some of the shadings and stuff.
Well, let me ask you a question. Okay, there's two things that are out there that you can get that will probably help your artwork a lot.
I think I have online.
Do you have Manga Studios?
No, I don't have Manga Studios.
Okay, Manga Studios is an inking program. I think 4 is probably the better one for inking comic books. It's basically what you do is you scan the art, you bring it into Manga, it gives you an extra layer, and on that second layer, you know, your pencil page will be on the back layer. The front layer is your ink, and it's got pens that can emulate ink pens.
Really?
Yeah, real ink pens. And you can actually, like, if you don't like it, you can erase it and go back and fix it. And then when you're done with that, you can either add duotones to it or you can add coloring to it. This, I mean, I don't know how much it costs, but it's really worth finding, you know, that program, because it will help you out a lot. The other thing the only thing with Manga Studios is if you get it, the problem is you're going to need a tablet. Can you draw on that with like a pencil?
Yeah, I can do
it.
Yeah, the tablet I have, I have a digital pen that I can draw on here, and I played around with it. But
it'll help your art.
I might look into it. I am so old school when it comes to that kind of thing.
But you're still drawing it. As a matter of fact, you can draw it and ink it in your style, and then bring it into Manga, and then revamp it, ink, change areas. Redo areas, give it thick and thin lines. I mean, it really
that's
will
pretty
change.
Incredible.
Yeah, I'll send you some stuff that I've done on Manga Studio.
I'd love to see it.
See,
yeah,
you'll see the kind of stuff that you can do with it.
Nice. Okay.
You know?
Thanks, man.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, for the most part,
it's more of a drawing thing as opposed to, like, I know you're drawing it, but you're just basically, even Photoshop has I think Photoshop has pen lines or ink lines.
They have brushes
and
whatnot.
They have brushes that you can work with.
I'm very basic. When I use Photoshop on the Mighty Blue, it's basically just throwing the colors, some burning and dodging to do some tones, some slightly different tones for shading and where the sun's hitting and just little things like that. And then I do all the word balloons and the copy in InDesign, just because I'm familiar with that program.
Yeah, no, sure, of course.
The font that I use, I think it's called Digital Strip, and it was a free font that I found online somewhere. Don and I talked about it years ago. I found it because I was looking for a font that's slightly different, something that can be used for comic books. And I love the font, and I think it works pretty well. What do you think about the font? Is it easily readable?
Yeah, it's readable. Yeah,
it's readable.
Yeah. Okay.
I would have liked one more, a little more comic strip-like, but, I mean, it does
the job.
Yeah, okay. I just wanted something that it was incredibly readable and didn't look completely like a computer.
But, I mean, honestly, it's quite an accomplishment.
Well, originally, Dallas would give me these sheets of paper. I remember when you lay it out, you'd have the panel borders drawn in ink, and then I'd see you pencil them. When he finished inking them, he'd hand them to me and ask me if I'd scan them in for him.
That's right. See, this is a homebrewed project, so Don actually helped.
So then you got your own scanner. But you're actually really proficient because you put these things out every week.
I used to, man. If I still put them out every week, man, I would be on like page 200 or so, like
see,
past
that's
200.
That's staggering for me because it was taking me forever just to do a 4-page story, you know, for my own amusement. And in my entire life, I don't think I've ever done more than 20 pages, you know. And I'm looking at this project, and it's you know, you're the volume you got printed out. It's nice on the tablet. I really enjoyed reading it. But I see this. I know you were staggered by it. It's really nice. It's a nice.
It's a nice package.
Yeah, man, you raised my self-esteem, Al, last time you were over and I showed
that
to you.
Really
you were saying how proud you are of me, how awesome it was.
I can see it in the store. I mean, it really looks nice.
Yeah, thanks.
You did a great job.
Story-wise, you liked it, Don?
Yeah, I did. Now, at the beginning, I was wondering why one of the characters had sunglasses, and this is absolutely like a Bronze Age type world. I said, well, was he drawing sunglasses? Well, then later on, I started realizing that you got another society that seems like they're technologically in the future.
Yeah.
I like that. I always like stories like that, where you have both worlds and they coexist. I also like the fact you're not really, you're learning things as the story unfolds. The only part I ever got confused, and again, you and I have talked about it, but is after they get out of that ice cave with that archer, you know, there's three of them, all of a sudden they show up at some city and they got a bald guy with them that I've never seen.
Well, okay, so, and I won't go into high detail, but that bald guy, his name's Andrus, he's shown up a few times before. If you go back, he's, He went to visit his dying father, and he learned some stuff about his family.
Oh.
And later on, he's on horseback reminiscing about that and thinking about what he's got to do, and he's going to join this group called the Demos Novus. So you see him a couple times peppered before his meeting with the main group. And at this point, he's joined the main group. And my whole purpose is just I kind of fast-forwarded the story by a day or two, and I didn't show how they met this guy Andrus, but he's joined the group now, and so like you were saying, there's two main characters, Danelle and his girlfriend, Karana. But the group's grown, and now there's five people in this group.
Yeah, they found an archer that it's a female that I don't think she really talks.
She's kind of like an Amazon.
And this really awesome, abominable snowman that's so cool.
I saw him, yeah.
And all of a sudden, it just switches, and it shows him going to the city, you know, the girl's on horseback, you know, the main protagonist that was smart. The other guy is missing, and there's this bald guy on a horse. Who is this guy? And see, I guess the issue is, Alice, that you're giving your audience too much credit because I never realized he was in there.
Well, it's funny because I always thought I was doing the opposite. I was trying not to spoon feed people because obviously a reader's a lot smarter than a writer might take them for sometimes, and I don't want to take that for granted. I just probably overplayed my hand right there.
Yeah.
But I'm really trying not to over-explain things. I'm trying to keep it to the point where the reader can figure it out themselves.
No, we talk about this all the time. There's an art to that, and that's an art that most of the time, if I don't, I'm not a writer, but whenever I tried to do my own comics, I was always told it was boring or it's confusing. If I try to explain too much, it's really boring.
That's
if I don't explain too much, it's just, you know, it's confusing. They can't really tell what's going on. And it's one thing, and we always talk about open source, storytelling, where you're able to come up with your own idea, and yet other people can work on the project, and it's nice. You know, it's not like some artists, when they make their own strip, like, and I'm going to say this, ElfQuest. The ElfQuest people, Richard and Wendy Penny, some of the best comics I ever read. But they were wanted to where other people could do those ElfQuest stories. To me, they just fell short. And some of these artists are like Leah Hernandez, who I like a lot. But I don't, it's just pales in comparison to the actual ElfQuest work. When Howard Chaykin was doing American Flag, some of the best comics I ever read. Other people worked on it, it just fell short. Dave Sim-Cerevis, I imagine if he ever passed that on to anybody else, I don't think in most cases it would have been as good as his.
This is influenced by Cerevis, I'm guessing, a little bit, right?
Oh, not intentionally, but I'm sure it is, because that's, as any listener knows, that's my favorite comic book is Cerevis, The Art of Arkans.
Not intentionally.
Yeah, so I'm sure, which is funny, because just a minute ago, Don was saying there's a scene where there's a character that's throwing a ton of information at you, and it's basically a talking head, going back and forth, saying all this stuff. When you get to the meat of it, he's throwing out a lot of opinions. He's throwing in a little bit of history, but his own perspective of it. And it's very reminiscent of a few key scenes in Cerevis and a lot of character tics that Dave Sim does. And so that was intentional, because I'm intentionally throwing all this stuff at the reader, kind of sidelining them, saying, first off, this is a lot of information, but second off, when you, on multiple readings of it, you'll realize some of this guy's, you know, perspectives are skewed, because those are his opinions, and you might not realize that on the first reading. Little things like that, I guess, are influenced by Dave Sim's writing.
Well, I would imagine so. The fact that it's already up to 140, I'm sure you want to stop at 300, right?
Well, that was 300.
That's 300 issues.
300
yeah,
issues.
Yeah, yeah. But that's already, that's like what, like...
yeah, this is... Oh, if I ever get to it, I have the overarching story and most of the big... I have points A to B to C. Like, I have all the main points that happen in the story all planned out, plotted out, you know. It's just the details now. And it's just getting off my lazy button, getting around to getting onto that computer, doing the next page, doing the next, you know, comic.
It's a panel a day.
I know, but
that's the other issue on it, is when you can write a story and it's a complete story, but you can leave things open for the reader's mind to fill in. That's an art in itself. That, well, I mean, there's a lot of artists and writers I like that have done stories that can do that, but not as many as I like. That's a tough thing to accomplish, and you did on that one. It's sweet. The only issue is the bald guy shows up. I didn't realize he was in it before. I guess that's the only kind of threw me. I don't.
For anybody that wants to read it, I think that's part 98 or part 99.
Page 98.
Page 98. Page 99. I call them parts because I released them.
Yeah, right.
By parts, you know.
Yeah. We have the circle theory, and we have a link on the sidebar from Buy These Guys. Can you still buy a copy of it?
You can still get copies. Circle Theory was a novel that I wrote years ago. I published it through one of those, like, on-demand publishing companies. So you can still order it through Lulu.com, and I think it's on the iTunes bookstore. There's a couple bookstores online you can find it, but
I knew you could buy it. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's called The Circle Theory, and it's just basically, it's a pre... Well, not a prequel, but it's a story that takes place before The Mighty Blue.
And The Mighty Blue is a prequel to that.
No, The Mighty Blue takes place after, is what I meant to say.
Oh, it's after, okay.
And it has to do with... The main character of The Circle Theory is not in The Mighty Blue, but a lot of the other characters, Dinelle, Kirana, the dumb guy and the smart girl, they're in The Circle Theory. They're pretty big characters. The queen of the Dar Aelnid, which is kind of the villains of the piece, the big queen, she was in The Circle Theory. She was much younger. Her father was king at the time. So you see things kind of change, advance, and a lot of the characters' stories and their arcs go in a different direction than you'd expect.
Nice. So, but if you ever look on the blog on the sidebar, it'll say Buy These Guys, and there's a link to where you can read The Mighty Blue for free, and also there's also a link where you can buy The Circle Theory if you are interested. I highly recommend it. So, anyway.
Thank you, guys.
And two thumbs up.
Thank you. There's plenty of places to find The Mighty Blue, just real quick, since we're talking about it.
Well, we have Four thumbs up.
Okay, and one big toe.
You can find the Mighty Blue, like I said, on my blog, mightybluecomic.blogspot.com. Mighty Blue's got a Facebook page. I peppered the two-dimension Facebook page. I peppered Mighty Blue stuff through it.
Yeah.
I'm on a few different webcomic sites, comicfury.com, smackjeeves.com, and I think there's one other that I can't think of. But anyway, there's a few different places to go read the Mighty Blue. I would absolutely love it if any of you guys out there wanted to check it out and read, you know, a few of the pages. If you can get past the pedestrian art and try and read it from the start to finish, and you know, I'd love to hear feedback and what I can do differently or just what you think about it. I'd love to hear it, guys. Thank you.
There you go.
All right. Well, what else we got? We got about 10 minutes left of the episode.
I do want to talk about something. One time, Al and I went to Wilson's Book World, and as always, Al says, "Don, have you seen this?" And it's Gilbert Hernandez's Sloth.
What?
That was a while ago.
Yeah. By Vertigo.
It's a hardback book. I've never seen it. I was wondering where that came from. It's I don't know if that was actually a comic series he put off of Vertigo. It reads to me like it was just a volume he put out through Vertigo just for that. Again, it's a black and white story. It's not based on any characters I've ever read. It's got a lemon motif. Lemons falling from the sky. It starts out with a lemon grove. It basically tells a story. I can't remember that character's name, but it's a male character, a teenager. And I think he said it was the third month of his junior year in high school. He went to a coma for a year. And then he came out of it, and he's still going to a lot of doctor's appointments, going through therapy. His grandparents are raising him. And as the story unfolds, they talk about his mother was a drug addict, and I guess she died. She disappeared. And her father was a drug dealer and is in incarcerated. And at one point, he goes to see him. And his father's kind of, I don't know, it's one of those type of guys where he seems to be in control and understand things and is bagging on the mother and how she just disappear on him. His grandparents, his grandfather's always talking about him playing football and how good he is, and the kid's never played football in his life. He said his grandfather's kind of delusional. His grandmother's kind of anxious and, you know, smothering to him, you know, trying to take care of him. He has two best friends. One's a female, which is his girlfriend. The other one's another guy, and they have a band together. He plays bass. The other guy plays guitar, and his girlfriend's a drummer. Well, as the story unfolds, come to find out that both him and his other friend were interested in the girl, and he ended up getting the girl. There's a lot of insecurities because he's thinking that they were in a relationship when he was in the coma. He was in a coma for a year, came out of it. There's three guys that are always showing up in that book that are bullies, you know, and the guy's kind of afraid of, and they're scaring. And it's basically talking about these relationships and the music, and, you know, it's a band, and everybody's got different opinions in the band and different directions they want to take. But they keep going back to this orange grove. Well, the orange grove has a lot of urban legends to it. There's a goat man that they say people have seen in it, which is really kind of scary the way Gilbert Hernandez draws it. They talk about these dead bodies in the orange groves. I mean, the lemon groves. You know, sometimes people take them out and murder. A lot of these stories. And one night they go out to the orange grove and they see the goat man. They get him on videotape. And the kid's convinced that his father killed his mother and buried him in the lemon grove. Now, when he's in the coma, the lemon grove shows up all the time. Well, then it starts taking a surreal turn. Because at one point, I can't remember what happens, but something happens to one of them. And he disappears, and the girl comes out. Turns out the girl was in the coma. And her parents...
It's starting to sound like a David Lynch movie.
Yeah, exactly. It reads like one. But her parents, who were in the first story, are completely different people. They're more like his grandparents. They're not her parents anymore. They're grandparents. But completely different. The grandfather is just hateful and spiteful to her. Just despises her. The grandmother's completely put out with her. Like, she's just so disappointed in her. And her mother's still alive, but her mother's in prison. Her father's dead. you know, it's kind of the opposite.
The opposite, yeah.
Well, when she shows up at the school, the boyfriend that was in the first coma, he's got women just coming to him right and left. Everywhere he goes, he's got 2-3 women with him. And she's always trying to get his attention, and he doesn't really quite know she exists so much. The three bullies in the first story are now two of her best friends, and they have a band, and they're DJs. And they're acting completely different than they did in the first part. The guitar player that was a friend of both of them is now a famous rock star. She's got posters on the wall, and when he comes to town, everybody's trying to get tickets, and they're sold out. So, you know, it went that way. It took a different turn. A lot of things unfold in it. And then there's a third break to it, which threw me too. I'll be honest, I really enjoyed it. Now, one thing, when Al and I were talking about Twilight Children that Gilbert Handes wrote and Darma Cook drew, you read the first two issues. And one thing you were saying, you liked the story, but you're saying...
Did that end already or no?
Yeah, I've got the fourth.
You should let me the third and the fourth.
I will. Well, you said you want to get the trade, and I wasn't sure if you wanted to finish it.
Is the trade out yet or no?
I don't know. Well, when we come back, I'll lend it to you. But you said that one thing you didn't, you're hoping that they would have the ending wouldn't be ambiguous.
Hmm.
And
well, don't tell me.
I'm going to tell you the ending. I'm just saying that that's one thing Al said reading the first two. It's just he was hoping that they would explain the story of what was happening to the spheres and why people were disappearing. And when he said, I'm hoping this isn't an ambiguous ending, I'm thinking, you know, a lot of times when Gilbert Handes writes these stories...
Yeah,
they are.
Well, but I will say the earlier Heartbreak Soup stories and Duck Feet, you know, those, they were, and I kind of like it that way because, again, that's what we talk about, over-explaining stories, you know, and how they finish.
And that I love that. That's what got me into the Palinor stories is that first handful of stories and the first few.
Those are second to none. Those are some of the greatest literature I ever read. And I consider them literature. They're not just comic stories. When he did Poison River, to me, that's when it changed. Now, he would do some stories that kind of come back to it. But again, Heartbreak Soup, Duck Feet, all those stories were just something. But he does tend to have an ambiguous ending to most of them. Sometimes it's just what you want, and it in your head you kind of fill in the rest. Other stories, I don't know. It's the ending's not satisfying for me, which you had mentioned. I don't know. It seems to me like he's trying to do more work than he can actually plan out and think about. Anyway, Sloth. I really found this one satisfying, and I never heard of it, and when Al pointed this out, I'm really shocked. I highly recommend this. If you got any interest in any of Gilbert Hernandez's works, this is right up there with one of them.
I've never read the story. I have no idea how it turns out or anything. I've just heard of it now, but I love the fact that he took...
You're going to be able to read it now.
I love that he dashed your expectation and took all these characters and suddenly put them in a different situation and different perspectives. Like, suddenly it's the girl in a coma, or however you explain it. Suddenly this character's not dead. Suddenly these bullies are her friends. What a great, unique writing idea to take that and halfway through say, you know what, now everything you knew about these guys is different. Let's take all these characters that we've gotten to know and just do something different with them. That's a cool idea.
Yeah,
I like that.
I guess what amazes me is how it changes each time. And it does this three times, but it changes, and you know it's different, but at the same time, it's like whenever you have a dream and everybody in your dream is sometimes combined, you know, two people are combined in another person, or the people you knew weren't acting exactly as they do in real life, and you know something's off, but you still know what it is. Like I said, in this one, reading the story, I knew who these characters were, and I knew how they were kind of mixed up and what they were doing. But it's kind of shocking.
Is sometimes, I mean, I'm going to go on, like I'm not really heavy, but whatever. Is sometimes ambiguity confused with poetry, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because it was like, what I'm trying to get at is, and it's a musical thing, I was something or another, Space Oddity by David Bowie came. And then, you know, there's a sequel.
Good.
There's a sequel to it, Ashes to Ashes.
Yeah,
you know,
I love
Funk
that.
To Funky. You know, Major Tom's a junkie. So I was thinking about the one song because I saw somebody do a cover. Is it so? Ashes, you know, Major Tom's a junkie. So is Space Oddity about getting high on heroin and crashing and ODing or whatever, or is it not? Because in this other song, which is the whatever he's talking about, maybe it's not, or is it just about something or other? And I mean, it's cool, but on the other hand, sometimes it's frustrating to me.
It is, but that's the beauty of art, because you can take it however you want to, however you interpret it.
Yeah.
That can be your definitive version, even if it's not the writer or the artist intended, you know.
Because when I was a kid, I just thought it was about a guy who, you know.
Up until just now, that's exactly what I thought. He was just a guy, literally, I took it at face value.
But you can think about it as somebody, like, getting, you know, shooting up and getting high and crashing or whatever.
Once again, that's just the
ability. Or you can look at it as alienation.
Yeah, I think that's kind of how... I think the old Space Oddity was kind of about a junkie, but I always saw it as a guy that, you know, went to space, was so caught up in it, he wanted to keep going. I always looked at Ashes and Ashes as that he couldn't keep going, had to come back to Earth and couldn't live with it.
Yeah, that's possible.
But that's how I see it, and that's one I call
it. I love that, though. Yeah. That's the beauty of art.
But it was just that line, you know, Major Tom's a junkie, and I go, oh, wait a minute. Because when Bowie does it in the song, you're really into the song and all the, you know, all the video and everything. But when I was watching a video, they did a Bowie tribute concert, and Michael Stipe was singing, and he's just singing it plainly and with a piano. You go, wait a minute.
And a big beard.
And a big beard that looks like Mr. Natural now.
From Crumb.
And I was like, I didn't really get that, because I haven't listened to Space Oddity in a while, and it was mostly a song from my childhood. But I was like, oh, yeah, okay. You know, and then I can see that in Gilbert's work. A lot of ambiguity.
Nice.
That leads to thinking that maybe he's aiming for it to be more poetic than just...
That's like kind of why I compared it to David Lynch.
Yeah.
As far as ambiguity and the way... It's all about, for the writer, for the artist, it's that portrayal. It's the way you show the listener or the reader what you've made. It's the perspectives you show. It's how much you do or don't show.
Yeah.
You know, that creates ambiguity.
But I also find that frustrating. Because
I guess
I'm the kind of person that wants... I want to know, okay, the end... Good. I don't want to be left on a question mark. Even though sometimes it's cool when the movie ends and you see like the monster dies and all of a sudden you see question mark, the end or whatever. You go, but I don't know. That's just me.
Well, and some work can do that to where, okay, a great example. A few episodes ago, we were talking about Lock and Key. Mm. Many layers to that.
Yes.
There can be some ambiguity to the story overall, but it's got a definitive beginning, middle, and ending. It's got a period, an exclamation mark at the end of the story to where things are wrapped up. You know what I mean? Like, you feel satisfied. You don't feel confused. You don't say, well, what did this mean so much? You know?
Exactly.
So although it does have a lot of layers, it's not as ambiguous as some things, and it's still incredibly entertaining.
It's still a story,
But because of the layers, you can still feel satisfied
on
a different level.
Yeah, there you go.
Guys, is there anything more you'd like to add?
Are these shows getting shorter? Because they just seem like we get started in their own.
We talked a lot about the Mighty Blue.
No, this is over an hour long, this episode, man.
Yeah.
I don't mess around. I don't cut it short.
It seems like it's 15-minute episodes all of a sudden.
No, you
shut your mouth.
It's just so much fun that it goes.
All right, guys. Well, Don L., thanks for joining me. Had a good time. It was really fun. Thanks for plugging my book, too, Don.
Oh, absolutely. Well,
yes.
thanks for letting me read it.
Blowing smoke up
my ass.
Go out
and read it.
Yeah.
But if you do listen to it and you like, again, it's on the sidebar of the blog, The
it's
Mighty
on
Blue.
Destination Nightmare, too.
And if you like that, you can read his novel, The Circle Theory.
And check out Al's blog, Destination Nightmare.
That's right. For Dallas's book. I almost said Dez's book. No, Dallas's book. Among other things.
And also, if you guys like us, if you like our podcast, and you're listening to us in iTunes, leave us a review. We would really appreciate it. We're really looking for that, you know, just to kind of knock us up so we can get a little bit more exposure. Would
and
be
send
really
us a
nice.
Few bucks if you want.
All small. Unmarked,
we accept money.
Then they start telling us what we have to read.
And really, I don't know if we've said this before, but if anybody out there has any books, comic books, that they want us to talk about, please let us know. Send us, if it's online, let us know where to get it. We'll read it. We'll talk about it, or send us stuff to review or. You know, any
that's a great idea.
There, you know?
Any suggestions, any recommendations, send us a message on the blog, send us a link to a book, send us a message on Facebook. We'd love to hear it because, I mean, we can always find stuff to talk about, but it'd be more fun if we were a little more involved with
everyone
else.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
And
we can be more involved with everybody else. We can help you out. We can join you work.
Yeah, I'd love this to be...
If we got a webcomic out there, we'll read it, you know.
I'd love this to be a community, you know. And we do have friends and supporters and people that are, that like us and talk to us on Facebook. And I'd love to be even closer to you guys.
That's right.
You know, discuss stuff with you. And if anybody ever wants to be on a show, too, maybe we can Skype it in the future.
That's right, yeah.
And if you have any songs that you made that you'd like us to
That's
play,
right.
we can do that, too.
Yes.
If you have a cover of Ashes to Ashes or Space Odyssey, just say
Preferably your own work.
That's a ton of information we just threw at you guys, so rewind it and listen to it a couple more times. All right, but thank you. Thank you so much for listening. You know, as always, it's a pleasure, and we hope you guys enjoyed it. We'll have another episode out in about a week. So until then, take care of yourselves, and...
Read more comics.
You can find Al's other podcast, Slow Robot A-Go-Go, Dallas's webcomic, The Mighty Blue, and Al's blog, Destination Nightmare, on the sidebar of our blog at bunchofdorks.com.
And click on the Cyclops.